It is an ironic tribute to the impact of the Cold War years that we call the current period the post-Cold War era. The enormous peril represented by a tense, decades-long standoff between two superpowers deeply affected our thinking about nuclear weapons and international relations. But there is striking evidence now emerging that is dramatically changing our understanding of many aspects of Cold War history. New interpretations of key episodes like the Berlin Wall, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Korean War provide us with a better grasp of what actually happened during an era that so profoundly marked the 20th century. My guests today are Christian Osterman, director of the Cold War International History Project at the Woodrow Wilson Center, Svetlana Savranskaya, a research fellow at the National Security Archive, and Hope Harrison, assistant professor of history at George Washington University. Welcome to you all. It's a great thing to have you here and to discuss some of these really remarkable findings. And Christian, let me turn to you first as head of the project. Why is this happening? I mean, what has changed that has made these new findings so possible and this new scholarship so fruitful?
What has changed is that we now have access to the archives of the former communist bloc. The Cold War Project was established now more than a decade ago, right after the fall of the wall, the collapse of the Eastern European communist regimes and the eventual disintegration of the Soviet Union, when the archives of these countries were opening up. The idea behind the project was to create a clearinghouse for a concerted effort to explore these archives, right, to new documentation. Because until then, really, we only had the documents, the archives, accessible on the Western side. We looked at the Cold War through the documents, through the eyes of Western statesmen, of Western diplomats.
Yeah. So what's different now is we're getting all sides, or at least better access
to
all sides. If someone were to put this to you, Christian, how would you answer? And I guess I'm putting it to you. What's the utility of this? I mean, what, in a practical sense, these new findings, this new scholarship, what will happen with it? What use will be made of it?
Well, access to these documents has, for one thing, led to an internationalization of Cold War history, of the creation of really of an entirely new field of international Cold War history. We're very, very insistent on the international in the title of this project. But we've also used these new documents to facilitate dialogue among former adversaries, Cold War adversaries. Excellent. Be it Americans and Cubans in terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis, or Azeris and Armenians in the Southern Caucasus, talking about empirical data, about documents, authentic documents, allows you to bridge political gaps in ways that we were unable to do before.
Well, that's excellent. As a further utility, so to speak, of this, has it had any effect on teaching, on what's going on in the schools? And I guess I throw that open generally, Hope, to you.
Very much so. I teach courses both at the undergraduate and the graduate level that integrate these new documents into the classroom, and the students love that, as you can imagine, and we use many of the sources from the Cold War Project, so that the students can get a real sense of what was it like, what was the other side thinking, what were the Soviet officials thinking about the Berlin Wall, what were the Chinese officials thinking, what were East Germans, Poles, to really understand the Cold War from their perspective, and that is of great use for students.
Indeed, I can imagine it would be. You know, I'm going to turn to each of you for some very focused attention on some of the major crises we face, but can't resist letting the audience see some of the handsome products that come out of this. This is your book, Christian, right?
Yes.
And it's on East Germany in 1953.
Right.
And I guess this is one of a number of publications that are coming available through the work of all of you and your colleagues in this.
That's right. We, given the language difficulties, one of the major tasks of the project has been to collect and translate these documents from the Russian archives, the German, Hungarian, the Chinese archives. Nobody can speak all of these languages, so in order to be able to integrate them into teaching, into scholarly work, they need to be translated.
Right. Well, I said we're going to turn to the crises and some specific instances, but let me risk a kind of, I hope, not too superficial impression of someone like myself who's read some of the things you've produced. If there is a kind of a unifying theme to the sorts of discoveries you're making, here's what occurred to me, that maybe it's giving us a new appreciation of the secondary powers. And I hope this is not too homely a metaphor, but I got the impression as I read your work, Hope, your work, Svetlana, your work, Christian, and the work of others, that sometimes the tail seemed to wag the dog during these Cold War years. Let me turn to you, Svetlana. Is that terribly wrong?
That is a very good metaphor for the Cuban Missile Crisis that I'd like to talk a little bit about. The more we study the Cuban Missile Crisis, the more the entire interpretation of the crisis is changing. And in fact, it's changing in quite the same direction with every major conference or major event in that issue area, is that the crisis was much more dangerous than we thought it was. And the role of a small power, Cuba, is now better understood as a result of the documents that have come out in the last 10 years. A great number of documents from Cuba, from the Soviet Union, from East European archives. And what it shows is that Cuba actually played a key role in the crisis, which the United States or the Soviet Union never acknowledged until recently. It also shows that there was this huge, incredible lack of understanding, really inability of the sides to understand each other. Right. And ironically, the United States and the Soviet Union, in the end, were able to negotiate with each other more fruitfully and understand each other better than the allies, the Soviet Union and Cuba.
Right.
When we know now and when we learned, which we didn't know 10 years ago, is that the Soviet Union amassed a great military force in Cuba, which included altogether 162 nuclear weapons.
Strategic and tactical.
Okay. About 90 of them were tactical, the weapons that would be used against the incoming invasion. The United States was not aware at all that there were any nuclear warheads on the island.
Let me stop you there just a moment to ask you about why the Soviets made that decision in the first place. I mean, in light of our metaphor about the tail wagging the dog, was there any sense that, Khrushchev in particular, if not the Politburo, really wanted to keep Castro on his side as opposed to perhaps slipping over to the Chinese side of the Sino-Soviet?
Exactly. Of course, there was a big competition heating up in the communist world for the leadership of the communist camp between the Soviet Union and China. And there was a real question in Cuba at the time if the revolutionary rhetoric of the Chinese was more appealing to Che Guevara specifically and to Raul Castro. So it was very important for Khrushchev to keep Cuba close, to keep Cuba on his side, and therefore also set a model for Latin America. What was happening, though, is that it was really the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, who insisted that Castro accept the nuclear weapons. Castro did not want to accept nuclear weapons. He wanted conventional.
Right. I'm going to probe that with you very, very profoundly. Christian, you had a comment?
Yes, I think there have been, one should say that we really don't have enough documents yet to say with full confidence what specifically caused Khrushchev to put the missiles onto Cuba. There are a number of interpretations. One is one Svetlana mentioned. Another one would be that he wanted to defend the Cuban Revolution. The Bay of Pigs had taken place a couple of years earlier, an American attempt to invade Cuba. There's the idea that Khrushchev wanted to rectify the strategic balance that seemed to shift in American favor.
So there are a variety of possible motives here.
And was most likely both, as in any serious human decision, several variables were involved. Clearly, there is evidence in the documents that we have that Khrushchev was very personally committed to the Cuban Revolution. And there was a perception that it was under attack from the United States. And this, what we also didn't know is how good the Soviet intelligence sources were. all the details of American plans, operational plans, and operations against Cuba were actually known to the Soviet Union in 1961,
you know, 62. That's an excellent answer, Fetnan, and you remind me of something else when you mentioned Khrushchev's personal commitment. How strong personality was in so many of these incidents, not Cuba and East Germany and Korea and elsewhere. Was there a time, and maybe this is what's leading to this question, when Khrushchev, because of issues of personality and volatility and control and all of that, might have gotten personally apprehensive, even frightened about Castro's possession of these? I mean, I guess the question is, what led him to take them out of there? Because they weren't part of the settlement with the U.S.
That's actually my favorite question that I'm looking for an answer to. And unfortunately, we don't have a complete answer yet, but what's happening is that for the United States, the crisis is essentially over with the Khrushchev's offer to withdraw the missiles. For the Soviet Union and Cuba, the real crisis is beginning because now Khrushchev has to take the weapons out.
Right.
And the tactical nuclear weapons were not covered in the Khrushchev-Kennedy understandings. So at some point in November, Khrushchev makes a decision that Castro is unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
He actually too risky, not a good ally, and he writes a long, like a 16-page letter to his representative in Cuba, Anastas Mikoyan, a very emotional letter, basically threatening that if Castro doesn't behave, the entire Soviet contingent, all the weapons, all the troops will be withdrawn from Cuba, and Cuba will be left alone there at the U.S. mercy.
Well, when he does that, of course, then that leads to or amounts to a unilateral decision on the side of the Soviets to take the tactical weapons out, right?
Exactly.
Now, that has to have, well, I guess I shouldn't get ahead of myself on this. Does it have a negative impact on the Cuban-Soviet relationship? I mean, what's the fallout from that decision?
It had a very serious negative impact on Soviet-Cuban relations. We didn't see that much of a fallout. The fallout was not very public, but the relations were strained for the next almost 10 years. Of course, Khrushchev tried to do his best to kind of bring back Castro's friendship. He never formally apologized, of course, but he invited Castro to the Soviet Union, gave him a long tour. Castro was treated very nicely. But what happened is that Cuba was not even informed that the tactical nuclear weapons would have to go. Cuba was faced with a de facto withdrawal, and Castro, in a very unusual for him situation, had to literally beg Khrushchev's representative not to withdraw the weapons, suggesting various ways to maybe rewrite the law, maybe ask Khrushchev again. But for Castro, this powerful personality, then who was ready to die and bring his country in the nuclear holocaust, to beg Khrushchev to leave these weapons and act as a dependent ally. And of course, that inevitably strained the relations, to put it mildly.
I would imagine it would. I mean, of course, Castro's willingness to die, as it were, is probably what worried Khrushchev
in the
first place.
Suggesting to Khrushchev that maybe Khrushchev should consider a first strike against America if America invaded
Cuba.
Well,
you know, this is what's fascinating about this scholarship, because this is a whole other side, and shows you, and having lived through that crisis now, I feel, you know, even more nervous about how close things might have come because of these issues of controllability. Keeping all this in mind, I want to turn us across the globe halfway to East Germany now. Hope Harrison has a handsome book coming out, and the title of it is, and that's a very colorful title I want you all to look for, Driving the Soviets Up the Wall, Soviet-East German Relations, 1953 to 1961. It's due this September, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, that's going to give us a lot of revelations about East Germany, and I understand, Hope, to start with, that the East German archives are perhaps the most open or fruitful.
Yes, that has been really wonderful. Because East Germany collapsed and was then integrated into a united Germany, they decided not to go by the usual 30-year rule and keep the archives open all the way up to 1990 when Germany was united. And it's just a treasure trove of documents.
Right.
And I've also spent a lot of time in Moscow in the archives when they were open. They're still open, but not quite as open as they were 5 or 6 years ago. And the same kind of thing, seeing this dynamic between the superpower and its ally, what I call its super ally, East Germany, We all remember the domino theory on the Western side of the Cold War, afraid if one country like Vietnam falls to communism, the others will. Well, the Soviets had the same fears about their allies, that if one fell, others would fall to capitalism. And this was most important in Germany, the front line of the Cold War.
Well, now, this is a very interesting circumstance. When we think of the Berlin crisis, we think of the crisis between the superpowers. You're talking about a crisis within the superpower,
yes,
so to speak.
Yes.
Now, is Walter Ulbricht, another personality that's a strong figure, these stories are almost novelistic in the power of the personalities. Is he literally the man who drives the Soviets up the wall?
Yes, he is, and that's the reason for the title. He is. He consistently asked the Soviets to close the border. West Berlin was located in the center of East Germany. East Germany surrounded West Berlin, and so West Berlin was this mecca of capitalism and democracy that drove Ulbricht and Khrushchev nuts. And Ulbricht really wanted to close that off so that his citizens couldn't escape through West Berlin to West Germany and couldn't see how life could be different. And the Soviets, shortly after Stalin died, the Soviets told these Germans, no, you can't close the border. No, you can't build a wall. We would look terrible. You know, the Germans, the Berliners would feel very bitter. We would look weak. We want to get along with the West. You can't do that. Find other ways. You've got to lighten your policies enough. You've got to moderate socialism enough so that the people will stay.
Right. Well, in that lightening the policies enough, you know, it's interesting because we have the Berlin crisis, which detonates over several years, coming to a head, but these two allies seeing it very differently in terms of how they want to use it or so forth. Now, the Soviets, with a global view, or at least a much broader view than these Germans must have had, had one set of desiderata and these Germans another, and the Soviets urged these Germans to adopt a, quote, new course.
Yes,
and they
yes. This was in 1953. They tried again in 1956 with Khrushchev's secret speech about de-Stalinization and calling for peaceful coexistence with the West. They tried to get Ulbricht over the course of about 7 years to change his policies. But Ulbricht, perhaps he was more prescient than the Soviets, looking forward to what ultimately happened in 1989, mm-hmm. felt that he could not loosen the reins of power. I mean, first of all, his personality was very autocratic, very Stalinistic. He didn't know any other way to rule. But he also really felt that if he lightened up on control, he might lose control entirely. He had a huge refugee problem. He knew people were unhappy going to the West. He thought, if I lighten up even more, the whole thing may collapse.
Right.
And sure enough, that's what happened in 1989.
You have a comment, Chris?
He was haunted by the experience of 1953 when an uprising by the German workers in East Germany almost deposed him. We actually at the time didn't realize how close Ulbricht came to being overthrown in June, July 1953. This experience we can now document,
right,
and it's in Hope's book, is haunted him for the rest of his life.
You know, it's interesting because at some point, at many points, this is a negotiating process, and you have two parties bargaining for what they want to get.
Mm-hmm.
And, the interesting thing is the wall goes up. So Mr. Ulbricht gets his point. And maybe I want you to comment on this, Hope, because it seems to me if there's such a thing as playing the card of weakness,
yes,
he plays it. Is that right?
Absolutely.
I guess Castro might have too.
Strength through weakness. And precisely because of this 53 uprising, it was so clear how weak the regime was. And Ulbricht kind of used that. You know, well, we might collapse if you don't give us massive economic aid and if you don't agree to close the border. And
right,
he kept using that argument. And ultimately, he did persuade the Soviets. He backed them into a corner. He narrowed the Soviets' options as to what to do in Germany and Berlin. By not changing his policies, by not making people want to stay, the only option to shore up the regime was to close the border. But Khrushchev drew the line there. He let him have the wall. He closed the border. But he did not go any farther. It's similar to the worries about Castro, that he's got an ally that's too unpredictable that could lead him to a major war with the West.
Right.
And so he sort of, in part, the wall ended up walling in Ulbricht himself in East Berlin.
I want to put a question to both of you, Svetlana and Hope. The China card, did both of these principles, Castro in Cuba, Ulbricht in East Germany, make use of it?
Yes, they did. I don't know if Castro used it consciously, but China was a major concern of the Soviet Union at the time. The Third World, and especially Latin America, was seen as the arena where the ultimate competition for the leadership of the socialist camp will be decided. And Che Guevara was clearly pro-Chinese. And Cuba just purged Aníbal Escalante, who was the pro-Soviet force in the Cuban right. leadership, the communist force. And so the Soviet Union, in a way, saw within their own camp as if they were losing Cuba to right. China, and that possibly was even worse than losing Cuba to the United States.
And in East
this
Germany?
Was a constant problem for Khrushchev. As one of his close advisors, Trianovsky, wrote in his memoirs, Khrushchev was always looking over his shoulder at China. A constant pressure. Ulbricht used it. Ulbricht and Mao Zedong felt they were in the same boat. They both had lost part of their country to the imperialists, Taiwan and West Germany. They both felt the Soviet should be helping them more to get it back. They both felt Khrushchev should have a harder line policy with the West, and so they often sort of compared their similar situations and supported each other in trying to press Khrushchev to be more hardline with the West.
You know, just what you've said in the past few minutes, I think, would make anyone with historical curiosity anxious to see these findings, because they're absolutely fascinating to get this other side of the story. And we can't leave the story without at least a brief mention of Korea. Which deserves a conversation, of course, in its own right. But I was struck, and I guess I'll pose the question very briefly because our time is brief on this one, by how a powerful influence Kim Il-sung was as North Korea's dictator in playing China versus Beijing versus Moscow to get the Korean War started.
Yes, and this is the wonderful work by Catherine Weathersby in Soviet archives that show that Kim Il-sung kept pushing and pushing Stalin, and Stalin said, but I don't want a big war with the West. Kim promised him, don't worry, it'll be short, we can handle this, the U.S. won't get involved. And so he sort of narrowed the view that Stalin had of the situation and thus was able to persuade Stalin to go
right.
ahead.
But he also played Stalin against Mao Zedong, the Chinese leader, saying to Stalin that he had Mao's support for an invasion, telling Mao that he had the Russian support, playing both against each other was a smart move on the part of Kim Il-sung in his efforts to launch an invasion.
You know, I get this, and again, I apologize for my somewhat childish little metaphors, but this has given me the sense of going around the poker table, you know, standing behind the hands of the various players in a way that's never been done before, almost having a mirror to see what the other guy had and you didn't know about. Which brings me to the concluding portion of our program, the moral of the story. And I know this could be itself... should be the subject of a book, but Svetlana, if you were going to say in a sentence what's really important about what we're finding out, what would it be?
From my studies, not only of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also the end of the Cold War, the biggest lesson, I think, is the great need for empathy, to be able to understand what concerns the opponent has. Not necessarily to agree with him, but to be able to look at the world, at least partially, through the other's eyes.
Absolutely.
Empathy, especially now.
That's a wonderful statement, quite frankly. Hope?
The much more complicated picture of what was going on the other side of the Cold War, the importance of these other allies, the junior allies, the importance of personality, and at times the importance of ideology. Mm-hmm. All of this comes through very clear in the documents.
Mm-hmm. Ideology. We haven't even talked about ideology. This is a very, very important factor.
Yes, for Khrushchev, that's what drove him very much in both Cuba and East Germany. He was what they call a true believer. Mm-hmm. He really felt we've got to show, not in a military competition, in an ideological competition, that capitalism is not the way to go. Communism is the way of the future, and he wanted to do all he could at the flanks in Cuba mm-hmm. and in East Germany to show that.
Right.
And so he was willing to put up with a lot from his allies in order to have a successful socialist regime in these countries.
Right. Christian, I'm sorry.
I completely agree with that. A lot of times people look back at the Cold War and they say, well, it was a superpower conflict. Mm-hmm. So it's perfectly explainable within the traditional realist framework of international relations. But you cannot understand the Cold War without understanding that the leadership, and I can speak for the Soviet Union, especially Khrushchev, were true believers in the ideology, the entire top Soviet leadership. And if you don't, if you're not ready to study ideology, you just simply
right.
cannot understand the Cold War.
Your perception, Christian, and especially on this point of ideology we're on right now, I think it's...
Yeah, I think we all expected getting into the secret archives, into the files to Politburo, that behind closed doors, the communist leaders would talk shop, would talk like Western statesmen do. Turns out that even in their conversations, the ideological coloring comes through. We've come to understand ideology not just sort of in the crude Marxist-Leninist terms, but in a way as a prism of how these leaders looked at the world. Yeah. And again, that underlines the point that Svetlana made about empathy, about being able to put yourself in the other side's shoes, perspective, not to sympathize, but to empathize with that perspective in order to understand it.
You know, I think, quite frankly, just to, as we come to the conclusion of this conversation, that's what I took away from it. And that would be the most important lesson, perhaps, for policymakers today, that this empathy is, there's never enough of it, and it has to be emphasized. And again, my shorthand for this was a willingness and an ability to look through both ends of the telescope and understand what was going on the other side. Well, Christian, I began with you, and let me close with you, just to get a sense of what's next and how the public might get involved in what's going on.
What's next? I think Svetlana pointed us in that direction. We're getting into projects that focus not just on the two superpowers, but the smaller powers. We're preparing a major international conference on the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. But we're also focusing on teaching, what Hope mentioned. We're conducting, together with George Washington University, summer institutes for high school teachers to talk to them about these new findings, but also how these new findings can be related and used in the classroom setting.
And we're going to do a website for that.
We're going to might have to leave it there, but that's what I call living history. Did you have a word?
Yeah, just a comment. The National Security Archive is doing summer schools every year for Russian young scholars of regional universities, in order to create that empathy, that ability to understand, or at least willingness to understand the other, and the readiness to look at the Cold War from the perspective of the other, which is very important.
Indeed it is. Thank you all. This has been a very rich conversation, and I think a very, very fine introduction to the work you're doing. There's a website, Christian, really quick. What is it?
cwihp.si.edu.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guests today were Christian Osterman, Svetlana Sabrinskaya, and Hope Harrison. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our production assistant is Jordan Berg. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's radiodial@aol.com.